morning to you all. Thank you for coming at this obscenely early hour to this presentation on behalf of Green's List Psychiatric Injury Cases under the Accident Compensation Act. Our speakers today are both well credentialed to talk on this topic. They're both extremely well experienced, and I've had the privilege of working with both of them. And I can say with confidence that they're very well versed in the area. The first speaker is Bruce McKenzie. Bruce is a senior junior who specialises in insurance, occupational health and safety, personal injuries. All of you will know him in work cover cases. I have had a look at his paper and you're about to hear it, so please welcome him. There'll be an opportunity to ask some questions, but I'd ask that you wait until both of the speakers have spoken before we have that. Could I introduce Bruce McKenzie?
Morning, everyone. I have prepared a paper that runs to some 20 pages, but so that you're not sitting there checking my spelling, punctuation and grammar, you're not getting it until the end. As a consequence, you don't need to make much in the way of notes. I'm speaking to the paper and trying to give you some of the highlights of it. At the outset with these cases, now just so we're clear on this, I'm dealing with the statutory benefit side of things, the workers' compensation side of things, the no-fault side of things. Fiona is going to be dealing with the common law side of things. Excuse me. Now, there's a couple of, as a general overview, the main issues in these cases are how you establish the entitlement, generally, how you establish the entitlement for incapacity specifically, and then the defences that come up in these cases. Now, the first topic is causation, and that is really dealing with the entitlement concept. And when I say entitlement, I mean entitlement under Section 82 of the Accident Compensation Act, 1985, as amended. I don't know what reprint we're up to now, but we're up to, as we all know, there's been a recent significant overhaul of the Act, and the reprint of that with all the amendments is coming out in about the 1st of July or thereabouts. With the establishment of entitlement, you establish the entitlement to all forms of compensation under the Act, save for capacity or incapacity or weekly payments benefits. That has some specific additional qualifications. In order to recover medical and like expenses or a lump sum impairment benefit under Section 98C, you need to establish the entitlement. The primary point is the distinction between injury in the primary sense and injury in the extended sense. Injury in the primary sense is also known as injury simpliciter. That in the psychiatric sphere is probably going to be something like a post-traumatic stress disorder, the bank teller subjected to an armed robbery in a case where the bank teller had no prior history of psychiatric issues. Probably the more common situation is injury in the extended sense, and injury in the extended sense means injury coming within the definition of Section 5, subparagraph C of the definition, and that means a recurrence, aggravation, acceleration, exacerbation, deterioration of any pre-existing injury or disease. And those words, we generally know what they mean. Recurrence means it comes back. Aggravation means the underlying condition's been made worse. Acceleration means the progression of the underlying condition's been moved forward or accelerated. Exacerbation means a symptomatic experience of worsening of the condition, like salt on the wound. And deterioration means exactly that. There's been authorities on that. I won't dwell on it for the purposes of this talk. They're covered in the paper. If you're dealing with injury in the extended sense, you need the additional element of showing that employment was a significant contributing factor. And the Section 5.1b sets out the issues that you have to cover there. But significantly, there's a couple of things that have come out of the cases. you can have more than one significant contributing factor. Employment can be a significant contributing factor even though other factors are more significant. And significant means more than de minimis, but less than major or dominant. Helpful general expressions and fertile ground for argument. One illustration of the idea is a case of Sangster and Kookaburra Security Proprietary Limited. It's a decision of Magistrate Brian Wright. Mr. Wright is generating most of the decisions in this jurisdiction these days because the Magistrates Court has had a jurisdiction for up to 2 years' worth of weekly payments. Now it has 2.5 years, and with the recent amendments, it has an unlimited jurisdiction. In the case of Sangster, it was a case of a person, Mr. Sangster, had two hats. One was as a company director, owner of the business, and the other was as an employee of the company. And it was hotly contested that his, in the circumstances of the company failing and eventually going under, it was hotly contested that his stress didn't arise out of the fact that he was employed or an employee of the company. It arose out of the circumstance of being an owner of a company that was failing. Ultimately, His Honour thought, having looked at it all, thought that probably both arguments were right, but that was nonetheless sufficient for the worker to establish an entitlement under the Act. Now, the next issue is you take your worker as you find them. It's particularly so in these cases, and as David said, something that's said in jest to one person might be horribly misinterpreted by the recipient. A case on point, the leading case on point is a case of Zlatesca and Consolidated Cleaning Services. It's been to the Court of Appeal twice. You only need to look at the first Court of Appeal judgment that's referred to in the paper. Mrs. Zlatesca was a lady who worked in a factory. She had a slip and fall outside of work on the weekend, presented a medical certificate to her supervisor, and then there was an issue about what the supervisor said and the way he conducted himself upon receipt of that. Mrs. Zlatesca said that her stress arose out of the conduct of the supervisor in relation to receiving this medical certificate. Ultimately, when the case was heard the second time round, it was concluded that the stress arose because she was a lady who knew that she needed to be physically capable of doing a job and wasn't because of this injury that occurred in non-compensable circumstances. It's an illustration of how you can have arguments about these cases and have red-hot arguments about what happened and what causes the stress, to use that generic term. Is it the fact that Mrs. Zlatesca knows she's not going to be able to do a job and is going to lose income as a result? Or is it some altercation in the workplace? These cases are different from the physically driven injury cases where there's generally no dispute or no particular dispute about the work process, and each side can view the work process, take photos, send engineers out, get a handle on what went on, rates, weights, heights, all that sort of thing. These psychiatric cases are very much who said what, the way in which it was said, the circumstance it was in which it was said, and the particular background of the recipient. For that reason, they are challenging cases, and the amount of work that's required for these cases is at least three times the normal sort of workload, I think, for a standard injury case. Now, a couple of interesting points that came out of Zlatesca on this idea of you take your worker as you find them is that, again, the act or omission of the employer, in this case the supervisor, only needs to be a cause and not the sole or dominant cause of the injury, and the employment itself does not need to create any special risk or special exposure to a particular injury. So it's variations on the same concept that you take your worker as you find them, but it isn't of any help to the employer to say that that's not the way that Mrs. Litescu reacted isn't the way that Mrs. Popovsky would have reacted. It's you take your workers, you find them, and everyone comes from different backgrounds in terms of life experience and so on. And it is no fault. This is the no fault sphere that I'm talking about. And again, you take them as you find them. A related concept is this one of perception. And perception of the worker is significant. Again, it's an extension of the same concept. The perception of the worker of workplace events or circumstances is the central issue. Provided the circumstances occurred rather than being imagined by the worker, then it's the worker's reaction to those circumstances that counts. Now, that the authority for that is New South Wales Court of Appeal, State Transit Authority in Chemla, and again, that's referred to in the paper. But in Mrs. Litescu's case, for example, if she had never handed the certificate to the supervisor and never had the discussion with the supervisor, then the issue wouldn't arise. The events need to have occurred, and that's also necessary to satisfy the arising out of test for entitlement generally. The other useful thing is that to come out of these cases is that the motivation, intention or other mental state of co-workers or management is not the issue. So it can be completely well-intentioned conduct on the part of other workers, and yet nonetheless, if it causes a reaction, an adverse reaction, then it can give rise to a claim. I put to one side the issues of section 82.2A, which deal with the reasonableness issues. There was a recent decision of Judge Susan in the county court in a matter of Asquith and St Mary's School. It's on appeal on a number of issues, and they include one, I think they broadly include one issue that I've covered in the paper, namely in Mrs. Asquith's case, she had extensive prior psychiatric problems prior to commencing work with the defendant, and she had treatment going back some 20 years with a psychiatrist. I can't remember what the diagnosis of the condition was, but it was extensive psychiatric treatment for a significant psychiatric condition before she started work with the defendant. Amongst other things that happened in the case, it was a case where there was no Section 82.2A defence run, but one of the issues was the employer was ringing Mrs. Asquith when she didn't show up to work, and this is prior to her making a claim. And they'd ring up and they were inquiring as to where she was, when she expected to come back, for the purposes of them organising their affairs, organising replacement teachers and so on. His Honour described the plaintiff as having peculiar vulnerabilities, and he described the conduct of the employer as perfectly proper in terms of these telephone calls and other matters, but nevertheless, they were perceived as being threatening by the plaintiff. She felt these calls were invasive of her privacy. They were threatening her continued employment, and they caused stress to the plaintiff. That was her perception of events. As I say, the Court of Appeal will be dealing with this case in the fullness of time, so we'll see what further clarification comes of that. Another issue that comes out of these cases, and perhaps more so than your average case, is this idea of blame. And there's a distinction between causation and blame. The only analogy I can draw is that it seems that motor vehicle property damage cases, seem to generate more self-righteousness than most cases, because everyone believes they're a good driver, and if they're involved in an accident, it must be the other person's fault. That seems to carry across to these cases, and I suppose it's because a lot of the time the worker will be saying that my supervisor was treating me badly, or matters of that sort. Ultimately, the worker is saying that they were treated badly by someone, or at least that was their perception. And it's an understandable human reaction to take umbrage at that and want to defend yourself. This issue has been considered by a number of the cases, and again, I'm talking about the no-fault world where issues of blame don't come into it. This idea has been considered in the statutory context, and Judge Strong, in a case of Allman, and Fords Limited, I think is the full name of the case, he said that he concluded that the worker was largely responsible for his own situation. Nonetheless, he was entitled to compensation. Magistrate Wright, in a matter of Turner and State of Victoria, same sort of comment. It's not a popularity contest. The worker may have been difficult to work with, may not engender sympathy from the judicial officer hearing the case or the representatives of the parties hearing the case, but again, it's a matter of injury, not personality. And that's what is significant in these cases, and there can be a tendency to get misdirected into issues of who was the better person or whose fault is it. It's not of particular assistance in these no-fault claims. Now, again, you need to go through these things carefully with your witnesses, whichever side of the fence you're on in one of these cases, and remember not to get too tied up in knots over issues of blame and personality contests and so on. The same concepts that I mentioned above about motivation, intention and other mental state of co-workers and management not being relevant apply here. Now that's the general threshold entitlement issue, and that's what you need to address in order to establish the entitlement to lump sum compensation, medical and like expenses and weekly payments. Weekly payments require an additional element though, and for that you need to establish incapacity. Incapacity requires that the incapacity results from or be materially contributed to by an injury. Results from has been interpreted, or that phrase results from or materially contributed to has been interpreted in Gretsch and Orica Australia Proprietary Limited, 2006 Court of Appeal, in the serious injury context, but the comments apply equally to the statutory benefits context. In that case, it was pointed out that the injury, again, doesn't have to be the sole cause of the incapacity, so you can have incapacity due to pre-existing problems and running in tandem with that, incapacity due to work-related problems. Material seems to mean more than trifling. The issue of incapacity itself, though, means the incapacity to perform pre-injury employment. It's a relatively straightforward case when the worker can't do any work at all, and it's a relatively straightforward case if the worker can't do their pre-injury employment, unless you're dealing with issues after 130 weeks of weekly payments, in which case you need to show no current work capacity, likely to continue indefinitely. But in your standard rejected psychiatric case, you're dealing with the issue of incapacity. There's been some recent clarification on the issue. There's a couple of decisions. The most notable one in recent times is decision of Judge Bowman, March 2009, in a matter of Kerridge and Monsfeldt Proprietary Limited. Mr. Kerridge was a tyre fitter who had psychiatric problems, had particular problems at the workplace with a particular supervisor. By the time the case came on for hearing, and long before the case came on for hearing, that supervisor was gone from the workplace. His Honour made a couple of interesting observations, and significantly what they seem to amount to is this. If you can do your pre-injury job at a different workplace or with a different employer, or at the same workplace with the same employer after the person you've had problems with is gone, then you're probably going to have difficulty establishing incapacity. And it comes down to fine points about what incapacity means, but incapacity is essentially the inability to sell your services as, say, a tyre fitter in Mr. Kerridge's case. So it's of no help to Mr. Kerridge to say that I couldn't go back there, particularly as the person that he'd had problems with had left. It might be different if the worker has a general block on that workplace because of bad experiences or matters of that sort. That decision's been followed more recently by Magistrate Wright in two recent decisions, Burns and Rogers. Each of those follow on the same sort of line. And Magistrate Wright's extended the concept slightly too to cover this idea of lack of confidence. And in both Burns and Rogers, the treating psychologists had reservations about the worker going back to the particular job because they needed a graduated return, they lacked confidence, and they were concerned about the worker getting back on the horse just yet, was the expression used in one of the cases. Interestingly, Magistrate Wright concluded that wasn't enough to establish incapacity. So the fact that you've got reservations about going back to work, you're anxious about it, or somewhat anxious about it, and your treating practitioners might have some reservations about you going back to your job, isn't enough. Again, there's room for argument in all of that. Now, the last issue is Section 82.2A. I propose to deal with it in two parts. There's claims lodged prior to 5 April 2010 and claims lodged on or after 5 April 2010. There's still a lot of cases in the system, and no doubt all of your files are relevant to cases lodged pre 5 April 2010. Those cases are going to take a long time to work their way through the system. So the paper covers that in a fair amount of detail. I've tried to draw together the relevant cases and the relevant concepts. There's not much learning on, as yet, on the state of play post 5 April 2010, but a lot of the concepts will carry over. The provisions we've all seen before. These are the provisions of Section 82.2A pre the amendments. The thing that remains in both is the concept of wholly or predominantly. The Commonwealth CompCare legislation is the safety, I can never quite remember the full name of it. It's the Safety Rehabilitation and Compensation Act 1988 Commonwealth. That provision is Section 5A1. They have this similar sort of concept, but they don't have the wholly or predominantly issue in there, or the wholly or predominantly qualification in there. The wholly or predominantly qualification is a significant one for workers, and it's been carried across into the amended version of the Act. Broadly speaking, a couple of issues arise. This issue of onus, it's been accepted for, now I'm dealing with onus in the context of the old Section 82.2A, it's been accepted for a long time, or had been accepted for a long time, that it was a mixed onus. The employer had the onus of establishing the applicability of any of these matters. The worker, paragraph A, B, C, the worker had the onus of establishing that the injury was not wholly or predominantly from one of those. The employer had to establish A, B or C first, then it was over to the worker. The matter's been considered more recently by the Court of Appeal in Department of Education at Unsworth. They accepted that it was common ground that the employer had the onus of establishing A to C. What was left a bit more unclear was what the onus of the worker was then. Some commentators suggest that the onus on both issues might be on the employer. It probably doesn't matter too much, but it will be interesting to see how that issue is finally resolved. The essential component for all of these things, as you'll see, is reasonable. Paragraph A, it's reasonable action taken in a reasonable manner, and then there's a number of categories of employer actions that are covered: transfer, demote, discipline, redeploy, retrench or dismiss. Those things are generally defined, or at least in a broad way, in the paper. Most of the judicial considerations have been on issues of discipline, and it was considered under the old regime that counselling wasn't discipline, therefore the employer couldn't rely on Section 82(2)(a). Investigation with a view to discipline was questionable as to whether it was discipline. And as I say, a lot of the cases have been focused on that. The decision on reasonable grounds not to award something is covered in paragraph B, and then expectation of the taking of any of those things. Interesting fine points in terms of what was actually driving the worker's psychiatric breakdown, and it comes down to a matter of qualification and careful analysis. Under paragraph B, one case that I was involved in, a case of Micklef, was a cleaner who had his shift changed, and the defendant's case was that his stress was as a result of the change of the shift. Mr. Micklef presented quite well and quite convincingly, I thought. His explanation was that working on the new shift meant that he had to clean a particular courtyard, and there was just too much in the way of pigeon droppings and cigarette butts for his liking, and that particularly disturbed him. He was accepted on that, and so the finding was that it wasn't the decision, but it was the changed work circumstances. Again, fine points, and again, fertile ground for contest. That's the regime under the old Act, and the rest of the detail is covered in the paper. This is the new regime. It's now simplified. There's no double negative in paragraph 2A. It's now mental injury. That may well mean that the onus is all on the employer to establish both the applicability of one of the reasonable provisions and also the wholly or predominantly issue. Again, it's an interesting point. It's now called management action. It's paragraph A, the taking of management action. Reasonable grounds, reasonable manner. B, a decision to take or not take management action, or the expectation. Now, this is the expectation idea is when the worker sees what's coming. So, for example, if a policeman who's under investigation and he knows that he's being caught out in whatever context it might be, in those circumstances when he suffers a breakdown, it's said that it's the expectation that gets called into play. The list of management action is extensive, and instead of going from the few categories that were in the old Section 82(2)(a), there are now, 14. The only highlights that I mention are that A is new, so B is new, and it's to cover the counselling doesn't equal discipline scenario that I mentioned. The suspension or stand down is new. The provision about investigation, paragraph M, that's new. That covers the situation I mentioned before, that investigation doesn't equal discipline. And communication in connection with an action mentioned in any of the above paragraphs. So that that will have some interesting scope as to what it all means. This is based roughly on the Commonwealth legislation, but it's more extensive than the Commonwealth legislation. You'll see that it talks about not limited to, includes but not limited to any one or more of the following. That suggests that there could be other things that you might call management action, but I think it's a case of wait and see as to how willing the courts are to extend those categories. It's been suggested that management action, on one view, anything that management does is management action of itself. But it's also been suggested that management action is probably more directed in this context at the idea of something to do with personnel matters rather than operational matters. Now, a few practical suggestions in terms of dealing with these cases. Lay witnesses. Lay witnesses need to be properly proofed for both sides. If you're acting for the plaintiff, you need to properly proof your plaintiff well in advance of the hearing. You need to properly proof any lay witnesses well in advance of the hearing. If you're acting for the defendant, the same thing applies. And it's more important on the defendant's side to proof your witnesses in response to what the plaintiff sees. You've no doubt seen circumstance reports that are just based on what the employer thinks the issue was, but there's been no real attempt to address the things that were really bugging the plaintiff. And it's only when you know what the drivers were or the stresses were from the plaintiff's side of things that you can properly meet the case. The next thing is relevant documents. If you're acting for the plaintiff, you want to see the warning notices or the performance appraisals or the policies and procedures on a particular issue, say the discipline procedures or the discipline protocols, and any warning notices that the plaintiff might have received. If you're acting for the defendant, you can come across cases where the plaintiff has a diary. I was in a case last year where the plaintiff produced on the day of the hearing a diary that ran for about 300 pages, detailing some 10 years of slights and misdemeanours. You want to know about those things ahead of the hearing so that you can obtain some sort of rebuttal evidence in relation to that. The next category is medical records. Both sides need to have properly examined the treating practitioner's medical records. You want to know about what it was that was stressing the plaintiff, particularly on the whole or predominantly issue. You want to know that the disciplinary meeting was in fact an issue or just something that broke the camel's back. If the plaintiff's been going to the GP complaining about sleepless nights, loss of appetite, nightmares, all sorts of things for many months or years leading up to the meeting, then it puts the meeting in some sort of context and you can deal with the issue of wholly or predominantly. Similarly, if you're acting for the defendant and there's no attendance with the GP or attendance is about coughs and colds, no reference to psychiatric matters, you want to home in on that. You also want to know from both sides' point of view what the other factors in the plaintiff's life were, marital problems, whatever sort of problems might have been there. Both sides need to know what they are. And finally, you need to know if the plaintiff's, look for things that the plaintiff might have said to the treating practitioners as to their intentions once the case is over, their intentions about going back to work and so on. And the final thing is psychiatric evidence. Your psychiatric opinion needs to cover the issues. It needs to cover wholly or predominantly. It needs to cover causation. It needs to put pre-existing, it needs to consider the relative roles of pre-existing problems and the work problems and non-work problems and the work problems, and it needs to deal with the issues of capacity that I've mentioned above. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Bruce. Certainly some food for thought there. You just love it when new legislation simplifies the existing Act, don't you? A couple of things he said that struck chord with me, this question of proofing witnesses. I think that's a terribly important matter, and often if you're acting for the defendant and you meet the employer who insists there was nothing wrong in the workplace, you get a pretty good idea of what sort of stresses the claimant was under. And the other thing is the diary. These cases are, as I said at the outset, you're not dealing with one frank incident. And if a claimant has a diary, it's almost impossible for the employer and fellow workers who are on the employer's side to rebut each of these perceived slights over a period of weeks, months, and often years.